Been there, done that. That's what two incumbent congressmen are saying, seeking votes in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District. We're questioning one of them, Democrat Leonard Boswell, on this edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation, the Iowa Bankers Association for personal, business, and commercial needs. Iowa banks help Iowans reach their financial goals. For decades, Iowa Press has brought you policymakers and decision makers from across Iowa and beyond. Now celebrating 41 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa Public Television. This is the Friday, October 21 edition of Iowa Press. Here is Dean Borg.
Shifting population produces strange circumstances. Last year's U.S. Census shows Iowa's population not increasing as much as some other states, so Iowa's losing one seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, going from 5 congressmen or congressional districts down to 4. But all of those currently serving want to continue. Republican Tom Latham, moving from Ames in the current 4th District, is challenging now incumbent Democrat Leonard Boswell in the new 3rd Congressional District. Congressman Latham seeking a 10th term. It's Congressman Boswell's 9th congressional campaign. And he's our guest today. Welcome back to Iowa Press.
Good to be here, Dean.
And across the Iowa Press table, Associated Press senior political writer Mike Glover and Radio Iowa News director Kay Henderson.
Congressman, in the news, on the edge of the news, Libyan insurgents with the support of the United States have gone in and killed Muammar Gaddafi. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm glad this despicable person is no longer there. When I think about what he did at Lockerbie and so on, he's a bad person. And they have taken it upon themselves to remove him. I wish and hope, for all that I can think of, that they're successful to be able to set a democracy and the people of that country have an opportunity to not live under a dictator.
And there have been a series of incidents lately where we've dealt with people who have been viewed as hostile towards the United States. Not all heads of state, but important people who viewed as hostile to the U.S. And I'm wondering how we should deal with them. Should we just go in? We had Osama bin Laden. We just went and killed him. Mm-hmm. We had Saddam Hussein. He was arrested, tried, and hanged. Mm-hmm. And now Muammar Gaddafi was killed by his own people. How should we deal with people deemed to be hostile to the United States? Just go kill them, put them on trial?
Well, I would hope they could go to the trial side if they have that choice. And I would say be very careful about it. And, of course, going back to the current situation you just make mention of, this was a NATO operation. We've been associated with NATO for a long, long time, since its beginning. And I'm glad that we didn't put boots on the ground. But we worked with our allies in NATO, which I think are very important to us as I've been a NATO supporter, which you've known for a long, long time, and I still am. And so I think that we did what we needed to do to keep our alliance alive and so on. But I am glad we didn't have to go to the point, or we didn't even, as far as I know, we even considered to put boots on the ground, but we did give support. And I'm glad that it's coming to its close, and I wish the Libyan people the best. I really do.
President Obama has called what you've just described, having NATO take the lead, Europeans take the lead in Libya, as, quote, leading from behind, unquote. Is that the appropriate way for the U.S. to move forward in foreign relations, to lead from behind? Republican presidential candidates have said no.
Well, I think you have to look at each situation as it, what you're confronted with, and they're going to be all probably a little bit different. But I know with all the turmoil going on the African continent, I know it's kind of reasonable to think about that the focus is going to be there in that part of the world. And we've seen what's happened in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and so on. I've been there. I've met some of those people over the years. And, of course, I spent 2 tours of my life in the NATO situation, 4 years in Germany years ago and 3 years in the Iberian Command Atlantic right there off the coast of Portugal. So I feel like I have a lot of background and understanding of that.
I'm going to go back.
I think the NATO has been a successful thing. Yes, sir.
Something that you just said. You said you wish the Libyan people the best. That seems to say goodbye and good luck.
The question really is, what's the U.S. role now in making sure that there is a democracy established there?
Well, I don't know that we can make sure, if you want to put it that way, Dean, but I think that we ought to encourage it and show them the fruits of what can happen, you know, based on what's happened in our country, what's happened in what we now see as the United Germany and so on, and France and all those countries in the NATO alliance. So I think if they can understand that and we work again together, they have a lot better opportunity.
But that seems to be almost a hands-off. You don't think the U.S. should take any additional role?
I think we have our State Department. We have an extremely good Secretary of State, and I hope that Secretary stays involved and there's things we can do. And USAID is something a lot of people don't understand, what great help it's been and to many countries, and sometimes just little things like water or shelter and so on. And I could give you some stories about that, but we won't have time. But there's a number of things we can do that are not threatening, but to demonstrate that you can send your children to school and they can have a future. And like I saw was with the children in Afghanistan last March, little girls, they've never had opportunity. Now they got opportunity, and they can contribute to the society, and because they can freely go to school.
Let's come back home, Congressman. There's a movement happening in the United States. It's known as Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
People who seem to be upset about the economic situation. What's your take on that movement? What do you think they want?
Well, I think they're disturbed. I think they see a threat to the American dream. And as you all know, I started out born in a tenant farmhouse, and look what I've got to do in my life. And I've had that dream, and I know my dad and my mother said, you know, we didn't get to go to school to do these things. I was first to go to college and so on. But I saw the American dream, mm-hmm. and I think that's getting very shaky right now. People are concerned about it. So the average working class out there are saying, you know, they're coming out of college, they got debt, they want to get a job, they can't get a job. And what caused this debacle, this big recession, was some of the actions that took place on Wall Street, and they're not suffering at all. They're making money hand over fist. They got all their benefits. They're living high on the hog, as we say down on the farm. But the common folks out here say, no, wait a minute. Look what we're going through. And I think that they're wanting to express themselves. And today's modern technology, every one of us has got we can get on the social network and they kind of know
right.
what's going on. And but they don't seem to have an agenda right now, except they're showing their unhappiness. What's happening to our dream when you guys up there on Wall Street are just going right on as if everything's just fine?
There are some who compare the Occupy Wall Street movement with the Tea Party, which
yeah.
became a very important force in Republican politics and has proved to have some staying power.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the Occupy Wall Street movement has staying power? Do you think it's going to be around for a while?
I don't know. I have no idea. It has that potential, of course. Ability to communicate with one another is like never before, and so it has that potential, but I don't see any leadership really, what little I've seen of it. Maybe you can tell me about
it. Does it have to have leadership?
Well, most things do, don't they? It's a new era because of the modern technology of communication, so where will it go? I don't know, but I know there's a lot of dissatisfaction out there as why do we have to recover from what we're into on the backs of the folks that we used to call the working class? Now, the working class we thought of for years and years, that's the people in line making the Maytag washers, if we could talk mm-hmm. about that, or the John Deere tractors. But you look at the cubicles in the principal and so on, those are workers out there that are making it happen, and those are people that in my life and what I see have had the chance to see the American dream. Every one of us, every one of you, as well as I, want our children to have better than what we had. It's just inherent. And they see that being destroyed. I just talked to a young lady who finished veterinary school last weekend and good grades and ready to go out, be small animal, big animal, whatever is needed, and can't find a placement. So she's going back home for the time being. And very disturbed, got this education debt and want to do something. But the people out there in the different clinics and so on, well, they're not sure where we're going, so she can't find a placement.
Well, one of the things that has happened in Iowa is that the protesters have engaged in civil disobedience, being arrested for staying past curfew at the statehouse grounds. Do you agree with the way the movement is prosecuting? It sounds as if you believe there should be some leadership emerge here and a more distinct agenda. Is that what you're hoping from this group?
Well, I think that it's not. We shouldn't be surprised, Kay. Whether they'll get momentum or not remains to be seen. I know that from being out with the public every day, so to speak, that there's a lot of unrest out there because of the pressures and the inability to find jobs and the inability to wonder if they can pay for their house payment and then see the folks at Wall Street that gambled with through the process of derivatives and all this stuff and got us into this mess, and they're going on the same.
But back to Mike's question, is this movement, so to speak, going to come to prominence in the same way the Tea Party has and be a force to be reckoned with within the Democratic Party? And do you welcome that? There seems to be a debate among Democrats. Do we embrace this movement or do we have a hands-off approach?
Well, I guess I haven't thought about it in that terms. I just say I'm not surprised that people feel that way because I know what's going on as you go out on Main Street. But I haven't thought about it in that light.
Let me go back to something you just said, and that is you said a lot of unrest out there. And you're seeing some of it in the protests, but you're seeing it across Iowa. What's the implication in that for President Obama?
Well, I think President Obama has gone the right track. Let's get people back to work. If we want to improve our economy, let's get people working. And let's be making things with American hands, and let's have it made in America. And I think that's what he's trying to do, is give incentive for small business to get started by incentives to, on the tax side of it, if they employ extra incentive, if they'll hire a veteran. And it just goes on and on. Those opportunities are there. Certainly, we know we need to do the infrastructure. The infrastructure is something you've heard me talk about for a long time. We have to move commerce. We have to move people. And we're falling behind. And that's something that we have to do anyway. So why aren't we working on that? And it's given us the opportunity to do it at no further cost to you, I don't think.
And Dean mentioned President Obama. You're facing, as Dean mentioned, a fairly tough reelection campaign. Can you tap into this movement to play a role in your campaign?
Mike, I'm looking straight in the eye. I haven't even thought about that tapping in idea at all. I am very concentrated on trying to do something with the economy to get people back to work. And as you know, I've been in the alternative fuels and things for years and years. And any opportunity we can put people to work, the infrastructure is something we could be doing, we can be doing, and we should be doing because we're falling behind. The cost to the trucking association, the cost to you and your cars when you go down the street, hitting potholes and so on. It's amazing if you put the figures to it. And we have to do this. And these are not exportable jobs. They're jobs that will turn in the economy at least three times, maybe seven. Secretary Vilsack and I was out here seeing this bridge a couple weeks ago. And we are now, fourth in the country for right here in Des Moines for the deficient bridges, a third, I think, as a state, and it needs attention. But as I talk to my colleagues across the country, why are we waiting for another Minneapolis bridge? Why don't we understand we got to do this? And we have opportunity to do public works. Go online and see what they've done at the Empire State Building. It's amazing. And payback is 5 or 6 years.
And you've been around Iowa politics for a good long time. You've been in Congress, as Dean mentioned, for a good long time. Is this your last campaign?
Oh, I have no idea that it is at all. I'm not even addressing that. I'm feeling good. I am very concerned of what's going on in our country and the world, if you will. You have said this before, but I think it's more prominent right now. Somebody like me, I've never been more prepared to be a participant in this. I went through the farm crisis, as your family did, Kay. I've done all these different things. I served in the military for a career. I've served in the state house. I raised a family. I got grandchildren, and they're worrying about their American dream, and I am too.
And so as long as you have your health and you feel vigorous and involved, you're there.
And people want me to be it. If they don't want me to do it, I'll step aside, but I'm interested. I'm concerned. I talked to my family about this, and they said, Dad and Grandpa, after we understand how you look at this, do it. And we're doing it.
Well, one of the things that you're going to do, if you are reelected, and it will be probably, you're working on it right now, and that is revising the farm bill. But you're going to have to live under it, whether you're reelected or not, because you are a farmer and you have farmland. Right now, there's something called direct payments, farm subsidies.
Yeah.
It's generally conceded that's going away because of budget constraints. What should be the safety net? Because there is a safety net being proposed that would not be as costly as direct payments.
Well, thanks for bringing that up, Dean, because this is something I've been involved in for a long time. We have to have a safety net. Now, just something that goes on, and I wish you guys would help out. You hear a lot of talk through the media and yourselves about the $7 corn and $13 beans and so on, but nobody wants to talk about the cost of input. And it ought to be put there so they can make the comparison. So I submit, maybe it's a ballpark figure, but it's that $7 corn's cost about $6. Well, you know, there's a lot of
risk. You're saying $6 to produce.
In that neighborhood. And, you know, there's people at Iowa State that could give you the exact figures on that, but that's ballpark. And when you think about that and you realize the high cost of the capital investment to go out there and put that crop in, you know, it's a lot of risk. They got to have that safety net. And that's, it's a federal crop insurance, and that's got to be available. And it's got to be workable, and it's got to be affordable. And that's one thing that I've spent a lot of time on, and I think that's it. And I believe that the producers out there, and I make no bones about it, I advocate for the producers. That's where it starts. And they've got to be viable. They've got to be able to withstand if things don't go well because, you know, we count on the weather and all these other factors.
But what are you up against in the way of people who say shouldn't be any farm subsidy whatsoever, not even a safety net? Other business people don't have to have that.
Well, it's an education thing. And the one thing that everybody has to do, regardless of what they do, is they've got to eat. And we all, and I have spent a lot of time on this, and I encourage the rest of you to help. Every American that has an invested interest in food production. I don't care if you live downtown New York City or wherever. And if you sit and talk with them, well, they realize that. So if they contribute to the subsidy, if you will, for the federal crop, they're protecting themselves. They've got an interest in this. And I can see why they would get upset about the direct payments and so on. When people were getting a payment when they had a good year, it doesn't make a lot of sense to anybody, and particularly to them. We understand that. But we've got to have the safety net. Now, federal crop insurance, again, has got to be available, affordable, accessible. And I think that's something that we can help people to understand. It's important to everyone, every man, woman, and child.
The federal subsidy for ethanol production has turned out to be the poster child for critics of federal subsidies of all kinds. Well, it's scheduled to expire at the end of the year. Is the ethanol industry destined to turn into the biodiesel industry when that tax incentive ended, biodiesel plants shut down?
Well, I think that the subject to ethanol is waning, the support of it. And what I would like to see happen, and I'm working very hard on, is the infrastructure out there to continue to provide that out, you know, pumps and ability to get it out to distribution points, to the gas stations, if you will, to the convenience stores and so on. And that's something I hope that we can see accomplished. But we have to stay on the alternative fuels, the renewables. We have to stay on it. We still are in bondage to OPEC, make no mistake about it. And what do you think it costs for a gallon of gas for us just to protect those mammoth ships coming out of that part of the world? Just think about it. And so we have to stay on it. And I'm very much into it because I was still in uniform in a foreign country when we had that first fuel crisis, and I got to see what happened to people, just like the three of you and me and people in any community. What they'll do if they can't get gas for their car, their delivery truck, and so on, it's amazing.
One other farm-related issue before we move on to other subjects. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has made a decision about dust, farm dust in particular. Yeah. Is this now an issue that has been decided, or should farmers be concerned that the agency will, in future years, come back and revisit this and perhaps restrict farmers?
Well, I'm going to keep an eye on them, and I want to talk to them some more. But just yesterday, I was with one of my people that's not familiar with what happens with the combine and what's the whole process, and I was explaining it, and then fog of dust coming up and so on. But this is a reality. It's not a part of the overall big issue as we think of the world, if you want to, the world environment. And if you're going to have crops and you're going to have gravel roads, you're going to have dust. And the EPA, when they went down that route, why they should have known that people like me and you and a lot of us could say, wait a minute, this is just stepping over the line. And there's other things that you ought to be concerned about, whether it's mercury or you could go on and on. But this is something that's just part of producing food, and we're going to have to do it. And actually, when you put it in the bigger picture of things, it's not that big a deal anyway.
Let's go to an issue that's actually touched your district very directly, and that's the flooding along the Missouri River. There's been a lot of flooding and a lot of activity on the part of state, federal government, local governments. What's your take on that reaction to the Missouri River flooding? Has it been adequate? Does there need to be more done? And how long before there's a recovery? How long will that take?
Well, it may take a while because, you know, the river, I haven't been out there since yesterday. You know, it's very serious, and it's been serious. We've known that now for weeks and weeks. And I think it's expected, and I certainly want to participate in a review of the whole policy and going back over their 14-year plan and so on. First of all, I don't think the Corps of Engineers have deliberately tried to do anything to harm anyone. I think they've tried to fulfill the requirements that have been put on them, but it's okay to review it and say, well, things have changed. You know, the tiling, the concrete, the malls, the highways, the parking lots, and so on, and the flow of how quickly water runs off the land. And so we got to continue to review that. I think a very intensive review must take place. And then we got to keep in mind, now, Corps, what do we expect of you? We want you to control the navigation of the river? Well, the first responsibility, I think, is flood control. And I think we probably all agree on that. Then it gets into all the other aspects of it, where it's irrigation water for those parts that need that, flood control, navigation up and down the river, recreation, on and on it goes.
Isn't the Corps in the middle of a fairly hot political debate? There was just a meeting over in Omaha with Missouri River states, and they couldn't agree on what the Corps ought to be doing. Yeah. How can, if the governors of the states along the river can't agree, what can you expect the Corps to do?
Well, I think the Corps, in all fairness, should come to the government, the Congress in this case, and say, here's the situation. There are going to be these reviews. You know there's going to be the hearings. And just lay it out there and put the facts out there and put daylight on it, let people see what's going on. And then sit down and have adult discussion about it and see what we ought to do with first concern about flood control.
So their mission ought to be redrawn?
Well, it ought to be reviewed and see where it needs to be. And I feel very strongly about that, and I think they're willing to do it. They don't want these floods to take place. And as I out there yesterday, and you know, what kind of shape are those levees in now after all that time of water being so high on them? I mean, what kind of shape are they going to be in? And we've got a short season now. We're going into winter. How much can they get done before we have the threat of next spring? And so it's a lot of pressure on.
You were earlier in the show an advocate for the transportation infrastructure projects outlined in the president's jobs bill. Mm-hmm. That bill has stalled in the democratically led Senate. What are the prospects of it, any of it, ever becoming law?
Well, I don't know, okay, but here's what I hope. I hope that the Majority Leader Reid, if he can't bring the whole bill to the floor because of the 60 rule, which I think is kind of hard to explain to people on the street or students out there in schools, it's hard to explain. But I think if he can't bring in the whole bill, bring it a piece at a time. Bring it a piece at a time and let the rest of the country see what people feel about it and where they want to go to try to get our country back up and get it to going and make us productive.
What's your view of this super committee that's meeting to come up with budget cuts? And if they don't come up with budget cuts, there will be quite draconian cuts in areas of the budget like defense.
Well, it remains to be seen. This is a new idea. And I guess I wasn't terribly enthused about it when it happened. The members on this super committee, they weren't elected by anybody's caucus or anything. You know, I got elected by my district. We go in, we caucus, we elect leaders and so on. But that's where we are. So, okay, I thought that that the group that was under Simpson and the Bowles was something that we should be paying more attention to. But maybe they'll pick up some of those things. Some of those things needs to be done. But I'm part of saying to them, and I've put my name on a letter to them, saying, you know, Let's go for the $4 trillion. Let's see what you can really do. Let's get serious about this. But at the same time, it can't be all just efficiencies cuts. There has to be other factors, which you all know what the word is.
And taxes. Taxes.
Has to be, no, revenue.
Well, do you support...
Congressman, in government, revenue is taxes.
Not necessarily. You know, if you're going to not... Yeah, but maybe it's other things, too.
Well, do you support the president's tax proposals and the proposal that was advanced in the Senate this week that would raise taxes on quote-unquote millionaires?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think everybody has to participate. You go back to 1913 and just go out online and look at what we've done as we went through these different crises, the wars and different things, and what's happened to the tax structure. And if everybody, and I feel if everybody participates, not just some, but everybody participates, we can solve this problem. If everybody participates and does their fair share, I'm very appreciative of people like Warren Buffett, what he said. When his tax rate is less than the person who works out on his reception desk, there's something wrong. And I agree with that. There's something wrong. And you can go to the money managers on Wall Street and the system they got where when their secretaries and are all paying more, there's no
Congress,
fairness.
There's
no fairness and no sense to this. And I think it's good to put today line. Everybody participate and we can fix
Congress,
this.
Way too many issues and way too little time. Afghanistan is now our longest war.
Yeah.
Do you support staying there? How long can you support?
No, I think we need to come home. I told the president over there in last March. We had a long discussion with him. I was there on a CODEL, and he said clearly that he hoped that we'd have permanent bases there. And I said, I just want you to know, I don't support that. Now, you're at a crossroads. You know where you can go. You got a choice. And you can see what's happening out there with the efforts we've made together. I gave him some credit. But with the efforts we made together, just for example, one of the ones I talked about earlier was the seeing these little girls in this school, to see their opportunity and to see what they could have if they'll get electricity and the lights will come on and clean water out to the different communities and so on. They can have that if they want to go that way. They're going to have to choose, or they can go back to their tribal system. If they choose it, that's their choice, but it's time for us to bring our folks home. It's costing us a terrible cost. I'm wanting for us to keep some people there to help train and so on. I personally know General Caldwell, who's been leading the NATO effort to train the military and police and so on, so they can have safety and protection. I think that's a good thing, but that too ought to be timely. But I think it's time to bring troops home.
There are those who argue that the troops, American troops left in Iraq, become sitting ducks for attacks because there aren't enough of them. Is that a legitimate concern?
Every one of us wants them to be safe. And I think we have to turn to our generals, people that are working that every day to make that assessment, our Secretary of State, people involved there. Nobody wants them to be there and be in an unsafe situation, and I have to rely on them giving us the information they've got available to them. But I think it over years and years and years and years, we've had people in different places around the world to try to help them train and learn how to do things that can do it better.
You told Mike that you didn't think there should be U.S. bases in Afghanistan. What about U.S. bases in Iraq?
I think it's time to bring them home.
Congressman, just a few seconds left here. Are you going to do anything differently in this campaign than you have done in other campaigns, given the state of the economy and given the new district?
Well, that's a good question, Dean. Right now, my focus, I think you can tell, my soapbox, my concern, the things I'm really concerned about is getting our economy up, getting jobs, getting people back to work. That will solve these problems. And that's my main focus, and, of course, a lot of it because of my seniority on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee is putting a lot of effort in the have for a long time. Yeah. And if we can do those things, we can get people to work. And I lived through the experience of Maytag, and we won't have time to talk about it. But
I have to interrupt. I'm sorry.
I am too.
Out of time. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome.
Next edition of Iowa Press, we're questioning Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, just back from China on a trade mission, now traveling state, getting support for the school changes that he's proposing. You'll see our conversation with Governor Branstad at the usual time, 7:30 Friday night, 11:30 Sunday morning. I'm Dean Borg, and thanks for joining us today.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa Public Television Foundation, the Iowa Bankers Association for personal, business, and commercial needs. Iowa banks help Iowans reach their financial goals.